solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
When you think of the scales and balance, your mind automatically goes to the necessity of trade-off, the necessity of sacrifice in one part of your life for success in another part, right?
Yep.
If I'm going to be successful at work, well, that means I have to give something else. I have to give up my personal life. That's how the balance metaphor works in terms of your mindset. If you put that aside and use a different metaphor that allows you to contemplate, what can I do in my life under my control that allows me to pursue my values, the things that matter most to me, and to do that in ways that allow me to have some success in all the different parts of my life, at work, at home, in the community, myself personally. Are there things that I can do that would allow me to create value in all the different parts, either directly or indirectly?
Welcome to the 40th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. This is a series of reflective conversations with leaders across disciplines on topics around leadership, transitions, and careers. I'm Deepak Jayaraman, your host and curator of the podcast series. I'm an executive coach, and I work with leaders and help them play to their unique potential by partnering with them during key pivotal transitions. To know more about my leadership advisory work, you might want to visit the About section at playtopotential.com. I believe that just like businesses need to be coherent about their answers to where to play and how to win, we all need to be thoughtful about our responses to the two questions, where to go and how to grow. This podcast is an attempt at exploring how some leaders across domains have grappled with these two questions as they've gone on their respective journeys. When we reached out to some of our listeners around end of 2018 and asked them for suggestions on how we could improve the podcast and take it to the next level, they said that you have a lot of interesting journeys and reflections. Why don't you get some thought leaders in? People who have spent significant amount of time thinking about a problem and have a deep point of view. In that context, I'm excited to announce my next guest for this podcast, Dr. Stuart Friedman. Stu, as he's popularly known, is a professor at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania and is the founding director of the Wharton's Work-Life Integration Project. He's also the author of the book Total Leadership, that's been a bestseller on several lists and has been translated to at least 7 languages. In our conversation, Stu talks at length about how we should all think about work-life harmony and not balance, because that suggests that it's a zero-sum game. He also talks about 4 domains that we need to be thoughtful about: self, work, home, and community. I do think that this is a significant epidemic, possibly amplified in India, where people place disproportionate emphasis on work while neglecting the other domains, and that invariably leads to some sort of a burnout or an event at some point or the other. I hope you find the conversation purposeful. Without further ado, over to my conversation with Stu Friedman. Stu, thank you so much for making the time for the Play to Potential podcast. Really excited to be talking to you.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me, Deepak.
And maybe a good place to start, Stu, is really taking you back in time and really saying, how did you zero in on work-life integration as an area of interest as an academic? What was missing in the work that had already taken place till then for you to pursue your research in this space?
Well, as a graduate student a million years ago at the University of Michigan, I had focused my research on how companies cultivate the next generation of leadership talent. And I did a large-scale study of half the Fortune 500 and looked in depth in those companies to see the systems that they used for selecting and developing the top three tiers of leadership, and what impact that had on the company's financial performance and its reputation. And I was mm-hmm. doing a lot of work. I was doing research, consulting, teaching on what I discovered about what I called succession systems, talent management systems. But I'd also had an interest in adult socialization. I'd had a longstanding interest in the roles that men and women play in society, starting from back in the 70s when I was a clinical psychologist. And it was just always something that I was very interested in. So I did advanced coursework in this area at Michigan, which was a great place to study these things. Mm-hmm. And then when my son was born, my first child was born in the late 80s, 87, that was a really transformational moment for me. And as it is for many people, when a child arrives in their life, except I had the good fortune of being able to talk about it with my students, because I was asking everyone after his arrival, what am I now going to do to make sure that the world is a nourishing one for him to grow up in? Mm-hmm. And it's a question that I hadn't taken very seriously until I met him, you know, when he arrived. And I just couldn't get that out of my head. And so when I walked back into my Wharton classroom sometime after his birth, a week or so later, I told the students, you know, we're not going to talk about the case that you prepared today on motivation and reward systems. There's something else that I have to talk to you about. And I just started ranting, basically, about how I was interested in this question that I want to now pose to you, dear students. What are you, as future business leaders, going to do to ensure the health and safety of not just the next generation of talent in your business, but the next generation, full stop? And there were a number of people who were quite annoyed with me when I did this, because they had prepared, you know, this case the night before until they were ready to talk about it. And, you know, this is back in the day when students prepared for class. all right, let's not go there. Sorry. But, you know, the real resistance was in how is this relevant for us? This is not mm-hmm. a business issue. And yet other people in the room, men and women, were quite keen to hear more about this topic and to talk more about it. And so when I said, what are you going to do as a future business leader and as a human being who might have responsibility for raising members of the next generation, what are you going to do? And one of them said something to the effect of, well, you're the professor, you tell us. Mm-hmm. And of course, all I was doing was asking the question, which it seems to be my particular talent, that I'm good at asking questions that provoke and annoy people. So I realized that was a turning point for me. It wasn't like I turned on a dime, but it really shifted my thinking about what can I do to help these people and others who are asking this question of themselves. And so I began to do research on what was out there, and there wasn't a lot. And so I organized the Wharton Work-Life Integration Project. And we launched in 1991, got some funding from alumni and from the school, and we started doing large-scale survey research. We went out into the field and found people who were exemplars at integrating the different parts of their lives in ways that worked for all of them, not just about child rearing, but all the different things that they did. How did they mm-hmm. do it? What were the principles they followed? What were the skills that they needed? And that, over the next decade or so, developed into a set of actionable ideas. So I started teaching them, and I could go on about that period, but
sure.
that was sort of the origin. If I just stay with answering your first question.
Got it. And maybe just picking it up and diving in, Stu, you talk about four broad themes, right? Self, home, work, and community. A couple of questions, right? One is, how did you arrive at this taxonomy? There's different ways of looking at life. So I'm curious about how you came up with these four. But also, I think work and home are often well understood, but self and community are often less understood. If I sort of talk from a point of, at least in India, the conversations I have with people around, people often frame the trade-off as I think we should talk about it as we move forward, but they understand work and home, but the other two pieces are missing. So I'd love to get your perspectives on how you got here.
Well, there had been a number of people writing about work and life, and I started reading what other people were targeting. And I was also reading philosophy and psychology. So my background is in psychology. And so these seemed like a good working set to capture most of what most people talk about when they think about the different roles they play, the different domains of their life. It's not a perfect taxonomy or categorization, but it seems to work pretty well, and it seems to work universally because I brought this now to all over the world. So the community piece, just to answer your question about what is that and how is it relevant? People struggle with that. And I often get questions about, well, what is community and why does that matter? Community captures kind of everything outside of you and your work and your family. So that includes your network of friends and neighbors, people in the place where you live. But it could also include people that you are engaged with in some kind of political group or religious group. So that usually has some meaning for most people. It may not be the most important thing. For some people, it is. And the self, of course, is who are you as an individual, in your own private sphere, the things that matter to your physical health, your mental health, and emotional growth, and your spiritual life, which is important to some people and not to others. But these aspects of our existence are, for most people, pretty important. So these four buckets, if you will, seem to capture most of our experience, and it's also simple. There's not 12 categories, there's just four. And last point about this, I ask people to define these domains of their lives in ways that make sense to them. So there's no rigid definition that I impose, but rather it's a device to help you to think about the differentiated parts of your life. And that helps you make sense of how to bring them together. In order to make sense of the whole, you've got to see what the parts are. And so people make their own decisions, choices about, well, what does home mean to me? How do I define family? And the way you define it might be different than the way I define it, and et cetera. So it's useful in that way that everything about this approach is subjectively defined by the learner, the user.
Understood. And maybe just picking up on one of the things you said, Stu, talk to us about what you mean by spiritual when you talk about self. Again, different people interpret it differently. How do you see the spiritual part of self?
Well, for some people, it's formal religion. Organized formal religion. But for many people, it is cultivating your soul, your sense of connection to other human beings, to, to some sense of the divine in our everyday existence. The interconnectedness of all things and the experience of feeling connected to something bigger than just you, that people have been, you know, cultivating since the dawn of time, the dawn of human time, and in very different ways, you know, in different parts of the world. But that's that piece, as I understand it and as I explain it.
Sure. And just one of the things that strikes me about how you think about this and how you frame this is you talk about how each of the domains is generative and there are positive spillover effects.
Yeah.
And rather than looking at these domains as trade-offs. So for the purpose of, for our listeners, could you talk a little bit about what you mean by this and, you know, how this is different from how people normally see it?
Right. Most people, when you talk about work and life, they say balance.
Yep.
And I deliberately called our project the Work-Life Integration Project in 1991 because I knew then, and I feel much more strongly now in the light of, you know, decades of experience and evidence, that balance is just the wrong metaphor, even though that's the one in common usage. When you think of the scales and balance, your mind automatically goes to the necessity of trade-off, the necessity of sacrifice in one part of your life for success in another part, right?
Yep.
If I'm going to be successful at work, well, that means I have to give something else. I have to give up my personal life. That's how the balance metaphor works in terms of your mindset. If you put that aside and use a different metaphor that allows you to contemplate, what can I do in my life under my control that allows me to pursue my values, the things that matter most to me, and to do that in ways that allow me to have some success in all the different parts of my life, at work, at home, in the community, myself personally. Are there things that I can do that would allow me to create value in all the different parts, either directly or indirectly through a kind of spillover? So if I take care of myself in a way that I haven't mm-hmm. before, perhaps through exercise or, you know, proper nutrition, what can I expect to see as an impact of that change on my performance at work or in my relationships with my family? Mm-hmm. And so you start to think differently about the possibility for what we psychologists call positive spillover or ripple effects, which exist. So when mm-hmm. when you open your mind to a different kind of metaphor than the scales and balance, and you think instead about the pursuit of harmony among the different parts over the course of time, then you see a lot more possibilities for innovation, for creativity, for change under your control that can produce gains or benefits or success, as you define it, in the different parts. And it works when you put on a new set of lenses and you look through them to see, all right, where are there chances for me to take action that are going to benefit my family as well as my work, as well as my network of friends, and how I feel about myself personally. You start to see those. And you certainly see more of those opportunities, those possibilities, than if you just assume, well, I've got to give up everything in my personal life for me to be successful in my business.
Hmm. And as you think about spillovers, I guess some of the spillovers are well understood too. Let's say the need to be healthy, and that will contribute to my productivity at work. Mm-hmm. But in your experience over the decades, are there spillovers that you see people significantly underestimating when they come to your class?
That's a great question. The most common insight for many people, for most people, is I need to take care of myself so that I can be there for other people.
Right.
That is by far the most common observation when I take them through a series of exercises that asks them to identify what matters most to them, their values, their vision, who matters most to them, the important people in their lives at work, at home, and in the community, and what those mutual expectations are among those key people. And then talking to those key people to really understand what those folks expect of you, not what you think they expect, but what they actually expect. Mm-hmm. You generate insight about ideas for innovation that you can take to produce what I call these four-way wins. So mm-hmm. many people come to the realization, if I take care of myself, I will be less cranky, more available, more energetic, and generally better in all my other relationships. So there's that. But mm-hmm. there are many, many different ideas for innovation that people come up with. There are 9 different kinds of experiments that our research team identified 15 years ago when we looked at the first 1,000 or so people who had done these experiments, as I call them, designed to mm-hmm. pursue a four-way win. And we classified them and now use those 9 different types to serve as examples for what people can try and to stimulate their own thinking. So, there are some really basic things that people come up with that they haven't done that they'd like to be doing. Like, for example, delegating more consciously to let go of some of the things that they do that are not high value and that other people may benefit from doing, that free you up to invest more of your time and attention in the things that really matter. So that's a pretty common one. Another one that is often surprising for participants is the notion of revealing and engaging with other people in ways that they haven't before. So mm-hmm. one of the first sets of exercises asks people to tell a few stories about their life histories. So what has happened in your life since you were born? 3 or 4 critical episodes that have shaped who you are and how you see the world and what you care about. Write those. Get reactions from colleagues. Everything that we do is peer-to-peer coaching exchanges. So you write those stories. Anything, you have to be willing to disclose those stories. There are many episodes in our histories that we don't want anyone to know about. So what are you willing to disclose? And the very first thing I do in my Wharton course, for example, which just launched last week, the very first day, I've got 55 MBA students taking this elective course, and I have them go into small groups and tell one or two of those stories. And it's extremely powerful as a way of building trust, having a clearer sense of confidence about being able to tell your story in a way that brings other people closer to you and also reveals to them who you are and what you care about and why.
Got it.
And so people then will say, there are more people who could in my life who could benefit from hearing that story or the story of my leadership vision, where I want to go 15 years from now and why I want to be going there and what I'd be doing on that day 15 mm-hmm. years from today. In the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening, and why I'm doing what I'm doing. There are people who might want to hear that. And so they decide to take that idea, those stories, and share them with people in their lives. With the intention of revealing their values, bringing other people closer to them, and enhancing their ability to inspire others. So that's a surprise for many people to realize that telling stories like that can be a powerful tool.
I think one of the things that struck me when I read your book, Total Leadership, was you talk about 3 pretty meaty and hard-hitting words, right? Authenticity, integrity, and creativity, right? that people need to have as they go through this journey of bringing harmony across these four dimensions. Could you talk about what you mean by these words in the context of work-life integration?
Yes. Well, so the Total Leadership Model, it came to fruition when I was recruited by the CEO of Ford Motor Company to be the global head of leadership development for that company. And that was about 20 years ago. And I spent a few years there. And I told him in the interview that I had for that job, I said, Jack, what I'm going to do is leadership development from the point of view of the whole person. And he said, great, do it. and that was my charge. And so I took what we'd been learning about work-life integration with what I'd been learning about leadership development, which was my day job. I launched the leadership program at Wharton also in 1991. So I'm developing the coursework for our MBA students, our undergrads, and I'm also doing this research on work-life integration. And what I came to see, and what really became super clear when we had the opportunity to do some really innovative programming at Ford, was that it's really the same puzzle. Growing as a leader and creating harmony among the different parts of your life, it's the same game. So that's hence total leadership, the whole person. So authenticity, integrity, and creativity are it's the short version of what we discovered in our research when we went into the field to find people who were good at this, who excelled at leading the lives they wanted to lead and were effective in that. And what we found is that they in common were these three qualities: being real, acting with authenticity by clarifying what matters most to you, your values, your vision. To be whole meant and means to act with integrity by respecting the whole person. And here I use the term integrity to describe, well, the Latin root of the word integrity is one, whole, coherence. So how do the pieces fit together? And that came to life in this program in what I was saying earlier about the identification of who are the most important people in the different parts of your life, why are they important, how do they fit with your values and your vision, and what do they expect of you, what do they need from you and you from them, and then talking with them to find out what they really think, not what you think they think about what's important. And in those conversations, you discover that what they need from you is actually a little less than what you thought and a little different than what you thought.
I was actually quite surprised to see that. You say that they often expect less from you than you think and are willing to support you more than you think.
It's true.
It's quite interesting.
Yeah. Try that. You'll see. It doesn't happen in every case, certainly. And I'm not making any guarantees about that. But that's generally what happens. And so authenticity, integrity, and then creativity. The other thing that we saw, you know, in these exemplars is continual experimentation with how things get done. They're always looking for ways to question the status quo and see new ways of doing things and to bring others along with them, focusing on results that matter, but being really flexible about how they get done and encouraging other people to experiment. So that's what we mean by being innovative, acting with creativity, and continually experimenting with how things get done. And that's what we have our students and program participants do.
And again, I'm curious, you spoke about teaching this course at Wharton, and I'm curious about how this shows up differently at different phases of life and how this ties in with the thinking around human development. So just to maybe pick three prototypes, right? Let's say somebody who's at B school, being prototype one, somebody who's maybe around mid-30s to 40s, let's call it midlife as two, and somebody who's around retirement as three. Do you see any big themes in terms of the nature of things that show up at each of these inflection points?
Yes. What was the third category? I didn't catch it.
One is student, second is midlife, third is retirement, right? Retirement as we used to know it earlier.
Yes. Different concept now for my generation. Yes. So with students, say MBA students, for example, people in their, mid to late 20s, early 30s, the questions that are most pronounced and issues that they are most commonly struggling with have to do with having the courage to articulate what they really want in their lives and to free themselves from the constraints of social expectations, parental pressures, and to really tap into what they feel good about, what they have some talent for, and what their real values are, and understanding what those are, and becoming more conscious, more aware of what those values are, and wrestling with those questions, finding a direction that is meaningful. Mm-hmm. So that's what's most pronounced at that stage. For the people who are 10, 15 years older than them, and I teach them as well in our executive MBA program, both mm-hmm. in Philadelphia and in California, where we have a campus in San Francisco. It's different because here you have people who are, many of them are in executive roles. They have families. Many of them are also responsible for aging parents, and they still have a lot of ambition, but they also are more humble because mm-hmm. they've been around and they've seen and experienced frustration and disappointment, and they have a better sense of their limits, but also a better knowledge of what it is that's really important to them. And that's really the sweet spot of the market, if you want to put it that way, for this kind of content. And indeed, mm-hmm. the program, when it was initially born 20 years ago at Ford, was designed for mid-career high potentials, which is mm-hmm. who these folks are. So there, it's how you be the father you want to be, the mother you want to be, the spouse you want to be, the citizen you want to be while advancing your professional goals. The questions of how you maintain and really invest in the really important relationships in your life become more pronounced then, mm-hmm. With advanced pressures and responsibilities, but also with greater assets and support and confidence.
Hmm. And also, maybe if I may add, I guess by that time, given that you worked for 10, 15 years, you also have, as you said, more realistic data on what you enjoy, what you don't, exactly. What gives you energy, where the skills are. So I guess that gives you meaningful data to work with at that stage.
Absolutely. You're clearer about what you care about and what you're good at.
Right.
So that's less the struggle. it's more about how do you lead in such a way that other people are benefiting from what you're doing, including your children, including, mm-hmm. Your friends, your society. At the later stages in life, the questions that are most prominent have more to do with how I can be cultivating the next generation as keepers of the flame, as the people who are going to succeed me. Those are the more pronounced questions for people in, say, their 60s and beyond is, what can I be doing? How can I be making, the most of my remaining time? Sorry about that. In terms of ensuring that you know, I've done everything that I can to bolster the prospects of those who follow me.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman. Of the three situations that Stu talks about, the middle one is an area of specific interest for me, possibly because of my stage of life, given I'm in my early 40s. When I reflect on my coaching work or conversations with some of my clients, friends, past colleagues at McKinsey and Egon Zehnder, I find that this is a time where three things often come together. Kids often need the most attention. Parents are aging and often need help. And career is often at its busiest. This is the power play phase where everything comes together and people are normally galloping in their career. This perfect storm across three dimensions can be tremendously unsettling. I'd written a longish thought piece on my take on this phenomenon, on how people could grapple with this phase. If you'd like to read it, you can visit bit.ly/navigatingmidlife. Again, the cases are important. Navigating has a capital N and midlife has a capital M and a capital L. You can also see the nugget context for this on the website playtopotential.com, and it has the link to this article. If you find the podcast of value, do take a moment to rate and review on iTunes. It will help others discover it. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Stu Friedman. And you've been doing this for several decades now, Stu. What has changed in terms of, I guess there's a lot that's happened in terms of digital revolution and, you know, the pace of life, the interconnectedness of life given technology. So if you took a snapshot of your thinking 20 years back, let's say 20, 25 years back and now, what are the big shifts in your thinking around work-life integration? What has changed?
It's a really good question. Certainly what hasn't changed is the importance of these three principles of being real, being whole, being innovative, and then reflecting on what you learn from trying experiments that are designed to make things better for the people who matter most to you in the different parts of your life, and to be more aligned with your values in terms of where you invest your attention. That has become even more important to more people, and to be reflecting on what you learn from consciously, deliberately, intentionally trying to create meaningful change in your world, what you learn about leadership and about creating change that's sustainable because it works not just for you, not just for your business, not just for your family, not just for your community, but for all the different stakeholders in your life. That has become increasingly important to more people, men and women. But in the digital age, in the early stages, which we're still in, a lot has changed, and so there's a much greater need, a hunger, a crying pain for people to learn how to manage the boundaries between work and the other parts of life, because it is so hard now with the ubiquity of information available to us through our smartphones and other digital devices to shut it off. So there are many more people doing experiments in the type that I call focus and concentrate, where the goal of the experiment is to try to do one thing at a time or focus on one person at a time. To bound your attention to one thing. There are lots more people doing those kinds of experiments now and seeing the benefits of doing that. So, with the power, the remarkable power of digital communication, making so many things more efficient, it's also come at some cost, which I'm sure you have thought a lot about, probably talked a lot about here. And what I see with my clients, with my students, is that this is a major issue that they are wrestling with how to deal with. How do we develop the psychological tools, the social tools that enable us to use these technological tools in a way that advances, the human prospect without, you know, undermining it or destroying it, which there's a risk of that. So those are two big ones. There are other shifts, including and especially the role of men and women in society, which has radically changed over these last few decades.
Sure. You also talk about the notion of psychological interference, to your point, across the four domains, and you say that comes in the way of people being effective in each of the domains. I found the term quite interesting. Could you talk to us a little bit about what you mean by that and how it impacts their effectiveness in each of the domains?
Yes, and it's one that we all wrestle with. So psychological interference across the different parts of your life simply means you're with your child, but you're worrying about a problem at work or a person at work who's causing you difficulty. She's looking right at you. You're having dinner, or maybe you're watching her, you know, play in a sandbox or do a puzzle or something, but your mind is not there. You're somewhere else. And that's psychological interference. That's when your mind is somewhere other than where your body is, and your thoughts are interfering with your being present. And that causes all kinds of difficulties, especially for kids, because they pick it up. They pick it up. And I've done research on this, looking specifically at children's mental health and how it's affected by their parents' experiences with work and their values about work. And one of our findings in that study, I just did a short piece out that I published, a digital article on hbr.org about this. Mm-hmm. One of our findings there was just what I tried to summarize, and that is that when parents, especially fathers, are thinking about work, when there's interference between work and family, their children have poorer mental health as a result. So it's a really important concept, and it's one that we can do something about. You can change that. It takes effort. You got to care about it. You have to know that it's an issue, which is why the stakeholder dialogues that we have people do are so crucial, because they really do send a wake-up call to many people, where you have conversations with, say, your children and ask, here's what I think is important to you. Do I have it right? And they're going to tell you, what I really need from you is for you to pay attention to me. Very common.
And on that point, Stu, you talk about in stakeholder dialogues, you say that expectations are often stated as positions and not as interests.
Yeah.
Again, I found that quite thought-provoking. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, in putting this part of the program together, we borrowed heavily from modern negotiations theory. And that's where this notion comes from. So if you read the great Roger Fisher and Bill Ury, Getting to Yes, which is one of the fundamental works in that field, you'll learn about this notion of positions, not interests. The basic idea there is what you want to find out from people as you're trying to discover new ways of doing things that are good for both of you, or agreements that are going to work for both of you, win-wins. You've got to get past the position and to the underlying interest. So what do you really care about? Well, I want you to be home more. Well, okay. But what's really important to you? Well, I just need you to be around more. Okay. Why is that important to you? Well, so that I know you care about me, that I know you love me, and that you have my interests in mind, and that you're going to do everything you can to protect me and to nurture me. Oh, okay. Let's talk about the different ways that I can make that happen, even when I'm not here. So you start to talk about all kinds of creative possibilities instead of arguing over when you're home. It's not so much about when you're home. It's about where your heart is and where your mind is when you're with the people who matter most. And this goes, of course, for people at work and in the community as well. So another thing that we found is that it's not so much the amount of time that parents spend with their kids that affects their mental health, their emotional health. It's the quality of that time. You know, am I present? And for moms, especially for mothers, it was a matter of, again, not the amount of time they spent with their children. And in fact, the more time that mothers spent on their own self-care, the better off their children were in terms of their mental health. And that, of course, is because when you take care of yourself as a mother, you're much better able to take care of your kids when you need to. So.
Goes back to the spillover point, right?
Exactly. Exactly. The relationship among the different parts, and especially taking care of the self. So one of the common trends over the years, I see this in just about every group, is that people rate, I ask them to rate their satisfaction with their lives, their sense of well-being in the four domains of work, home, community, and self. And the self is always rated lowest for groups, because it's just easiest to let yourself down. But once you start to dig in and realize that if you don't care for yourself, you really can't perform well in the other roles that you have, that's when you start to realize that you've got to take care of yourself in order to be a better leader at work, a better father, a better friend.
That's a great insight. Rather than treating it as a residual variable, you start solving for it.
Exactly. That's a good way to put it.
And you also talk about the art of interruptibility as a key capability for the leader of today. Again, I found the term quite intriguing. Talk to us about the nuance here.
Well, that was a term my friend and colleague, now deceased, Joel DeLuca, came up with to describe the ability to shift attention in a way that allowed you to be intentional and focused on, all right, now I'm going to move my attention from this conversation to this piece of work or this activity, to just be intentional about how you get to move from doing one task or one conversation to others. It's a skill. And so to be interruptible, the art of interruptibility is about really just that, knowing how to interrupt yourself, interrupt exchanges that are occurring in a way that is both graceful and considerate, and minimizes the cost of moving from one task to another, because there is a cost in terms of residual brain processing. Your mind just doesn't go immediately from one thing to another without there being a transfer of attention that has some cost to your brain. So training to do that well is what the art of interruptibility is about.
Got it. And you also, talking about Joel DeLuca, talk about being artfully political.
Yes.
While managing multiple boundaries. Again, I found that quite intriguing as well. Talk to us about how this plays out in the way we manage the boundaries.
Well, so Joel DeLuca is this really smart guy, and he wrote a wonderful book called Political Savvy, Leadership Behind the Scenes, and I've learned a ton from that book. And so some of these ideas in Total Leadership on the chapter that's about moving your ideas forward in the real world. So after you've done some self-analysis and thinking about and articulating your values, your leadership vision, after you've identified the key people in your life and talked about your mutual expectations and gotten a better understanding of all those social forces swirling about, and you've gotten a clearer picture of what you need to do to better align who you are with what you do and who you surround yourself with and how you serve them, well, then you've got to start to make change. That's the be innovative part, the creativity part. And you soon learn that there's going to be resistance whenever you try to change something. So when you are trying to make change happen, as DeLuca teaches so well in his wonderful book, you've got to, of course, serve the interests of the people around you. So that means to be artfully political is just that, to know what the real interests of the people around you are, and to do everything you can to adjust your plans. So I have my students, participants, clients, they develop a game plan and a scorecard for a change that they've designed, an experiment that takes place over a month or two in pursuit of a four-way win. And as soon as they try it, they realize, well, this isn't working because I forgot to think about how my boss was going to react, or my colleague, or my client, or my wife, or my kids. And they have a stake in this. So I'm trying to create time and attention for me to, say, take care of myself, maybe go for a bicycle ride with my children on the weekends as a way to connect with them and be healthier and for all the benefits that might come from that. Let me try that. And then you realize, well, you thought you were going to go for a bicycle ride with your daughter on Saturday morning. Turns out she's busy and doesn't want to do that.
She often has a busier calendar than I do.
Exactly. So to be artfully political simply means to be conscious of the interests of other people as you're trying to get them to support you in when you're trying to do something new. And that's a big insight for people. From many of the participants, it seems simple and straightforward, but it's a really important one. And the good news in that, of course, is that you can be smarter about what the interests of others are. And that's one of the main insights people take out of this program. And that's why it's really about leadership, creating change, and bringing others along with you as you're doing that.
Got it. Now, I think, as you talk about your program, you also talk about individuals in some cases working with coaches as they go through the journey.
Yeah.
In your experience, of the various steps and of the various things that transpire in this process, if I may call it, what are the 2-3 areas where you see coaches adding disproportionate value? And what I mean by that is, what are the steps which are often harder to do as an individual?
I'm glad you're asking about this. So There's a couple of different kinds of coaching experiences that I try to create for people. The main one, though, and there's an appendix in the Total Leadership book that takes you through a process for how to set this up for yourself. The main method is peer-to-peer coaching. So what I'm trying to do wherever I go, whether it's speaking to 2,000 people at Lincoln Center in New York, or if it's 12 people sitting around a conference room, a senior leadership team at a bank in Madrid, or anything and everything in between, I'm always keen to create a learning community where people are committed to being compassionate, caring, curious, candid, and where they are helping each other. And they take seriously the responsibility to be useful coaches for their peers. And the key elements of how to do that are not that complicated, and almost everyone can do it, at least start doing it and feel comfortable doing it, and that is demonstrate interest through genuine curiosity about what's inside the other person. And really, the main thing you got to do is just pay attention and ask questions without judgment. And we find that when you put people in peer-to-peer coaching pairs or trios or quartets, and you have them, say, tell the story of the critical episodes of their life history, or talk about why the people that they've chosen is most important in their lives, at work, at home, in the community, why those people are important, or what they're discovering through their stakeholder dialogues, or the difficulties that they're facing in trying to get their experiment going because they're afraid to try something new because they might fail. When you put people in a coaching experience, peer-to-peer especially, you build accountability, mm-hmm. and you build support when it works well. And those are the two key forces that really help propel people on a path to change, an intentional change. And you need that. Now, we also work with professional coaches to supplement the peer-to-peer coaching. And that's another powerful means of gaining another perspective, being held accountable, and really being compelled to articulate your observations, your reflections, your ideas, your fears out loud so that you understand them better. It's all good.
Sure.
I mean, coaching from as many different angles as you can, you know, afford, given the time and cost, is it always helps.
Got it. And just maybe a couple of questions before we wrap up.
Okay.
As a student of transitions, one of the pieces I'm curious about is how people should think about the where to play question, right? If I bring it back to strategy, what should I do next? Again, in the context of your thinking across these four domains, when people come into your program, how should people think about flexing the boundaries within the current canvas versus looking for a new canvas?
Mm-hmm.
Have you found interesting insights come up here? Because the framing of the question often elicits different insights. So when should people stop stretching the boundaries and realize actually this is a canvas where, you know, all four domains cannot work? Maybe I need to find a different canvas. What's been your finding around?
Well, I think your approach to working the canvas that you're currently got in front of you to its limit is the smart approach. The theory of small wins is an important kind of concept that is underlying the design of this total leadership method. And the theory of small wins is really very simple. You get a lot more done when you take small steps in the direction that you choose, because it's easier to take small steps than big leaps. There's less risk and you learn faster, because you take one step and you realize, oh, maybe I need to adjust a little bit in my direction in this way so that I can get to where I want to go and bring others along with me. You learn more, you develop confidence, small steps at a time. So it's incremental change toward the big idea. And many people think, well, you know, my work situation is terrible. I got to get out of here. I'm miserable. Instead of thinking, well, are there ways for me to make some experiment, some small experiment that might create a different approach, a different feeling, a different sense of myself in this role with a less radical, less risky adjustment. And so trying those first is generally a wiser approach because it costs less and you learn more faster. Did I answer your question?
Got it. And absolutely. I guess once you've tried whatever you could try and you hit the limits, and then maybe it's time to move to a different question, but point well taken.
Yeah. Yeah. And if Herminia Ibarra has written great work on this, especially in her book, Working Identity, when she studied career changers, and this is essentially what she found, that it's wiser to take a small step in a not radically familiar environment, but in the one that you know, and see what you can do to craft your job, change your experience, or in other parts of your life, in ways that are better aligned with what you care about and what you're good at.
Got it. So, Stu, this podcast is titled Play to Potential, which is about people discovering what they have potential for and then playing their best game to unlock their potential.
Mm-hmm.
So, in summary, as we wrap up, what would you like to leave the listeners with for people to play to their potential?
I think that's a wonderful title, and I think it's an important aspiration for all of us at different stages of your life. You know, what that potential is going to be, of course, is going to change over time. But I think the fundamental insight related to that I've developed in my work is that your potential is not limitless, and to focus your investment of, you know, where you're going to play, what game you're going to play, on something that you care about deeply and that you have some talent for. But you know, caring deeply about what it is that you are, about the game that you're playing, is fundamental. And that's why this, you know, the leadership aspirations that we have, they start and end with your values and your vision of the world you're trying to create. So I would urge your listeners to try to have the courage to reflect on, you know, the legacy that they want to leave with their lives, and to be doing everything they can to adjust, to focus their efforts on investments of their time and talent on those arenas of action where they get to play the game that they want to be playing.
Lovely. On that note, Stu, thank you so much for taking the time and for your insights.
Deepak, it's been a real pleasure. You know, I do a lot of these conversations and interviews, just, you know, hundreds of them over the last few years especially. And I have to say that this is really very enjoyable and thoughtful, and I really appreciate the opportunity to get to know you and to talk with you.
Absolutely, Stu. Thank you so much, and appreciate you making the time.
Thank you.
Three things struck me in this conversation. First, I couldn't help but notice a meta theme in Stu's journey. Even before he'd started the work-life integration project at Wharton, he'd started integrating the various domains of his life by talking about some of the elements around family and community in the Wharton classroom when his child was born back in late 1980s. Second, I see most people around me often solving this work-life integration as a two-piece puzzle where they think about work and home and try to optimize for that. But noticing that you need to solve for yourself, which is physical, mental, and spiritual health, to be effective in other domains is a key insight for me. And I really like the notion of four-way wins and taking on an experimenter's mindset as we go about our life. In a way, some of these themes came up in my previous conversation with Dr. Ramachandra Guha, who spoke about the various experiments that Gandhiji did as he went about his life. So the piece around having an experimenting mindset was a valuable insight for me. The third piece that really struck me was that this is not a solo exercise, but something that needs to be solved in the context of your life and by involving all the key stakeholders and by engaging with them. Very often people seclude themselves to create the mind space for reflection, but I guess one needs to be mindful about how we engage the key constituents of our life and move forward. If you want to know a little more about this, you might like my conversation with Arun Myra, who was a former chairman of BCG India and a former member of the Planning Commission in India. He spoke at length about how systems thinking can help us navigate some of these situations. Thank you for listening. I hope you found the conversation as purposeful as I did. If you found it of value, do take a moment and leave a review on iTunes and share it with people that you think could benefit from this. I look forward to having you at one of my subsequent conversations at the Play to Potential podcast. Signing off, this is Deepak Jayaraman. And to know more about the leadership advisory work I do, please visit the About section of playtopotential.com. Bye now.